Innovation, disruption, and big issues. This is Business Game Changers with Sarah Westall.
Welcome to Business Game Changers. I'm Sarah Westall. I have a departure a little bit from what I usually do, and I have a professor of religion and philosophy. His name is Dr. John Caputo, and he wrote a book, Philosophy in Transit. And it really is about paradigm changes and how you accept the truth and how you see truth differently over time. And it usually comes with events. It really ties into what we do here on the show, because the show is all about bringing what's on the edge, what's changing the world today. You know, innovation, disruption, and the big issues. Things that I think, and the listeners think, because I'm getting all sorts of ideas from listeners, on what's changing the world, who's changing the world, what ideas are changing the world, what's going on in the world that needs to be addressed. Otherwise, the things that are changing the world are going to be awful. You know, the big issues and the changes. And he gets right to the crux of that. And it's really difficult to think about changes in the world without thinking about how philosophy and religion really ties into it. Because at the end of the day, we're human beings, and it's not just about economics, it's just not about business. It's about how our communities and how we react to what's going on in the world. And with the truth perspective, that's really what's going on now. Everybody's trying to figure out what the truth really is, and people are being bombarded with different paradigms of how the world really is, and different cultures are clashing together with our new information age. It's been around for a while now, but not long enough where whole cultures have completely integrated yet, and we're seeing just a ton of culture clashes, chaos with that, plus chaos with the amount of change that we're seeing as we're moving into another era of humankind. And there's medical breakthroughs, like some of the shows I've been doing on significantly expanding our time on this planet. So these things are all going to come down to how we deal with it from a philosophical, religion, ethical base. And so it's important that the leaders in our society, the people who are on the edge of change, can start thinking about these from different perspectives like this. Now, you're not going to believe everything he says. You're not going to agree with everything he says. But the point is to listen and get something out of it. If I agreed with everybody that I brought on the show, I probably wouldn't have anybody coming on the show. There are so many things that people are bringing forward that are on the edge that it's hard to accept at first, right? Because it's a different paradigm. So I just hope you will stick with this whole thing. He has profound things to say about what the kingdom of God really is and what truth means and how paradigm changes occur. So I hope you stick with this. It's an excellent interview. So let's welcome Dr. John Caputo. Hi, Jack. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Thank you, Sarah. It's good. Glad to be here.
Well, you have come very highly recommended, especially with your background in religion and cultural studies, and also you wrote a book back in 2014 about the truth. I'm just going to read some quotes, and I'm hoping that you can expand on some of those. Well, let's start with, truth is the shock of the unknown that breaks into our lives. What do you mean by that?
Well, I'm trying to go beyond the classical and perfectly acceptable definition of truth that you get in ancient philosophy, which is in a very sober way to say the truth is when we say and think of what is, that it is, and of what is not, that it is not. So that's our mind conforms to reality. Now, I don't want to dispute that idea of truth, but I want to try to pick up a sense of the experience of truth and what the philosophers call the phenomenology behind it. That is to say, the way we in our lived experience encounter truth. And the emphasis that I put in the book on truth is this notion of breaking up the received. So there's a kind of you know, the received wisdom, the commonplace, and the thing that sort of the sort of truths that tend to lose their life and become and are repeated in a sort of commonplace way, and then you know what we're calling true is not quite so true. It's the truth being trivialized and reduced to commonplaces. So what I want to say is that truth, when you think about it in a more robust way, surprises us. It for better or for worse, right? I mean, sometimes the truth that comes breaking into our lives is bad news. And when that happens, then we say, I can hardly believe this happened. And we also say the same thing when it's good news, but with an entirely new sense. So I think that the sense of truth, the power of truth, the value of truth that I want to bring out is that of discovery, of invention, of breaking up the received wisdom and opening the horizon to something new. So I'm not contesting the old classical idea of truth. I'm trying to sort of move past it and give a sense of the truth that catches us by surprise, that breaks in upon us. Which happens everywhere. It happens in ordinary experience when something good or bad happens to us. It happens in science when they discover things that just baffle them because they didn't expect that to happen. And then when that happens, you know, sometimes it's just it's just an anomaly and it can be ignored. But sometimes it's a breakthrough that's going to change everything in that discipline. So that's my emphasis. My emphasis is on the future, the novel, the incoming, the inbreaking, the shock, the trauma of literal trauma, not pathological trauma, the actual rocking that we experience when we get hit by the truth, which also suggests to the problem of hiding from the truth. It is not above us to hide ourselves from the truth. And sometimes we can't hide, and it breaks in. And St. Augustine says, you either love the truth or you hate it. You know, you love it when it's on your side, and you hate it when it tells you breaks the bad news to you. So I want to give, you know, I want to bring out those sort of sharp edges of truth and push past the perfectly acceptable classical idea of truth, which is that it's the conformity of our thinking with reality.
Well, you say that how important faith is to keeping an open mind and pursuing heretical notions that eventually evolve into commonplace appreciations. I think that's what you're saying here in a eloquent way. It's when paradigm changes happen.
Yeah, there's a sort of what the philosophers call a logic of sedimentation. You know that when a discovery is made, when a breakthrough is achieved, the first reaction to it is it's crazy, and then eventually, by hook or by crook, it becomes the established way of thinking. And then it sediments, you know, it hardens over, it becomes the received wisdom, and then it becomes the thing that needs to be put into question. And you see that in religion's a good example of that, because in religion you have these reformers and seers like Luther who make breakthroughs, and then it gets codified. It gets distilled into propositions. It gets bottled, canned, and passed along. And then the Reformation needs a reformation. You know, and I think that's something like the logic. That is the logic of truth, of the truth process. So the ultimate resource of thinking, in my view, is openness, keep keeping yourself in a state of what I like to call optimal disequilibrium. You know, a certain kind of imbalance, not too much imbalance, or you'll just fall right over, but a kind of optimal disequilibrium in which you're ready for, in which you prepare yourself for something for which you can't be prepared. You know, you're ready to be surprised, you're open to something that you didn't know was, or you didn't see coming. You know, there's a kind of openness to letting your own presuppositions be put into question.
Do you think that
in an optimal way? Too much of that is just skepticism and chaos, and too little of it is dogmatism.
So, do you think we have an unhealthy balance now compared to any time in the past, or is it pretty consistent over time?
Well, the present is crazy right now, because we're living in a time that is sort of a shocking time in which what I call optimal disequilibrium, it's not optimal. We're in a state of disequilibrium now that is descending on us, which I think is quite dangerous, in which the attack upon fake news, the attack upon reliable sources of information, undermining any source of information, will throw us into chaos. I mean, if in order to be surprised, you have to have been expecting something. So in order for us to, our openness to the future is not simply utter, it's not pure, perfect, utter openness, because we think there are certain things that we have, a certain wisdom that we've accumulated, which we don't want to freeze over, and we want to keep it open, but we don't want to just simply say anything goes, that anybody's truth, that there are as many truths as there are people. We don't want to call into question the sorts of things that make it possible for us to make progress. We don't want to question everything, you know, randomly and wildly. So, and I think that's the problem now. We're starting to get into an anything goes attitude about truth. And when Kellyanne Conway uttered this sort of fateful expression, alternate facts, you know, you say, that's the abyss. You know, we're on the abyss when you start thinking like that. That's a not an optimal disequilibrium. That's just flat out random anything goes.
Well, do you think, though, that by not talking about the truth, you know, there's kind of a media blackout on certain topics, that's another way of not getting to the truth, and that's sure. What a lot of our problem is.
Sure, absolutely, right. I mean, that's the normal case. The normal case is the normal situation, and the one that I had in mind when I was writing this book was where you're dealing with the power of received opinion, and you're trying to break it. You know, you're trying to get make a crack in it and let something new grow through the crevices of this structure that's in place. That's what you're normally dealing with. What's happened in the last 12 months is that's disappearing. There isn't any received truth. There are just factions of truth and factionalism and polarities and a breakdown of the conditions under which you can have a discourse. I mean, let me give you an example. Take the example of Copernicus. What Copernicus said was revolutionary and shocking, but he was by far the first person, he was far from being the first person to say that. If you go back through the history of of philosophy and science, you'll find a lot of people who said that the Earth was not at the center of the universe. But they were speculating. They didn't have any experimental evidence, and they didn't have any mathematical demonstrations to show that that was the case. They were speculating. I mean, if you go back to the history of philosophy or history of thought generally, you can find almost anything you want to find. Somebody somewhere will have said it. So a number of people said that the Earth was not the center of the universe. A famous Catholic cardinal said the sun's not the center of the universe either. He says the universe is infinite. And we say, well, that's very interesting. Do you have any evidence for that? And he really didn't, no. So it had no impact in the history of science. When Copernicus said it, he said it in a certain context, in a certain state of scientific knowledge, in a certain state of experimental evidence, and he had a proof for it. So when he said it, it was utterly shocking. The greatest scientists of the day were very reluctant to believe it. But it, because of the protocols of thinking and of scientific research that were beginning to form, they realized he's right. He's right. So if the conditions are not, if the conditions of established knowledge are not in place, nobody's going to discover anything, because it's just a random opinion. And my concern right now is that we're getting to the point where when someone wants, people can simply dismiss truths they don't like to hear. When Thomas, or when Augustine said that sometimes that we hate the truth, well, our defense mechanism is when we hear a truth that we don't want to hear, we just say it's fake. Mm-hmm. Now, and if that's your recourse, if the principle of simply dismissing a claim as fake gets in place, heaven help us.
And we're seeing it from all sides of the spectrum.
Yeah. I mean, I must say, it took me by surprise. When I wrote this book 3 years ago, it was that was not the case, and that's why my emphasis is on. I'll give you another example. One of the things I'm really interested in is, and you can see it in the book, is this idea of the event, the in-breaking event, which takes us by surprise. Well, sometimes you can have too many events, and then the result is not progress and revolutionary new beginnings. You just have chaos. And I was, I've done some work with some nurses in an association of nurses in Canada. And the person who runs this particular group, and they're interested in philosophy. It's a very interesting combination of nursing professors who are interested in philosophy, and they're interested in problems of like this, problems of truth and discovery. And so I was going on this day, one day, about the event and the idea of the in-breaking surprise and the sort of trauma of something, something that breaks up our ordinary life. And they said, well, you know, our problem, and the nurse who was speaking was a pediatric oncologist, okay? I mean, just the expression sends a shiver down your spine. She's dealing with children with cancer. She's not only dealing with children with cancer, she's dealing with their parents. And she's dealing with them every day. And she says, our problem, my colleagues and I have a problem not of making space for the unexpected event, but of too many events. She said, we're constantly dealing with life-shattering tragedies. And I said, well, you know, that's a really interesting thing to say to me, because that's not the way I'm thinking about this. I'm thinking about the sort of steady course of ordinary experience and how we can open it to something unexpected. But sometimes the unexpected can overwhelm you and throw you into chaos. And I think something like that is happening right now with respect to the nation, this community, which is this national community, keeping its bearings and moving forward in a way which is in which there can be some semblance of consensus.
Well, it's hard to create a new foundation, a new infrastructure of thought, if the change keeps coming over and over and over, waves of change before you actually created a new framework.
Yeah. Waves of change and the undermining of the ability to discern which is what's right and what's wrong, and that's the problem. I mean, when you start questioning and dismissing received opinion arbitrarily and for ideological reasons, you're creating the conditions of chaos. I mean, the people who are dismissing climate change pose a profound danger to this country, because they're dismissing very well established scientific experimental claims for ideological reasons. And they do it by saying, by creating a conspiracy myth, and by saying that this is fake news created by an elite. Now, when you get that established, you get that frame of mind in place, and you're inviting catastrophe.
Well, I think people believe that there's geoengineering going on and other things. So it's not, they can't argue that there isn't global weather changes, but they're believing it's from different sources.
Yeah.
And that, I think,
Yeah, they think it's natural climactic.
Well, there's some people think that, and then there's other people think geoengineering, like the governments of the world are actually messing around with the atmosphere and trying to do experiments with weather, and that's affecting climate change.
Yeah. Okay.
And so that's another perspective, and there's quite a bit of adamant people that are researching it. I'm just throwing that out there. I don't know. My whole show is about business game changers and looking at paradigm changes, bringing leaders and fields in this whole thing. And that's why I wanted to talk to you so much, because you're trying to understand that whole paradigm of this phenomena.
Right. Yeah, I think that's when truth is sort of glowing white hot, when you start making paradigm, those periodic points of paradigm shift. I mean, you can't have paradigm shifts every afternoon. You have paradigm shifts are the exception, not the rule. But the distinction between the sort of progress we make inside of a paradigm, which is important because it's the day-to-day work, not only in the sciences but in the humanities and in the social sciences as well. It's the way we work in all the disciplines in any kind of research. The distinction between that kind of progress and the progress that comes along when someone says something that completely reframes everything, which is utterly shocking, that, it seems to me, is the most important distinction to make when you're thinking about truth. The common distinction we make is between the humanities and the natural sciences, and we think the natural sciences are hard knowledge and the humanities are soft knowledge, and that meaning that the sciences are objective mathematical and the humanities are interpretive and subjective. I think that's a sort of distorted way to look at what's going on in the sciences and the humanities and the difference between them. I think what's much more interesting is what they have in common, and that is they both obey this principle of work, activity, research, investigation that goes on within the paradigm, and the shocking, traumatic moment of paradigm change, because that happens everywhere. That happens in not only in science, in people like Copernicus and Einstein, But it happens in the history of, it happens in painting. Painting is a really good, the history of painting is a really good example of exactly that. When Picasso started, when Picasso's first cubist paintings began to appear, people thought he was crazy. The establishment thought this stuff was absolutely bizarre. And they began, one of the signs of a paradigm shift is when someone starts to say, well, is that even art? Is that even painting? Or is that really science? So like right now with the paradoxes that the quantum physicists are uncovering, the scientists who are a little bit wary of some of this are saying, well, is that really science? Well, it's when you're at that point where you start asking the question, is that even art? Is that even science? That something, either something crazy is happening, which is going to just pass over, or something revolutionary.
Well, I think, go ahead, keep going. I don't want to cut you off. You've got some good things.
The interesting thing is at that point, you don't have criteria. You've got to make a judgment. You need discernment. You need insight. You need to make a judgment. You don't have criteria because the criteria belong inside the paradigm. When the paradigm itself shifts, you're out there. You know,
you don't have a framework right now to analyze it and to figure it out.
Yeah, you don't have what they call an overarching framework, or what the philosophers call a meta-language. We've got a framework and a language, and then we can operate inside that, and we can establish rules inside the framework. So we can have rules for what we all agree is art. And what the community of interpretation agrees is art, or science, or religion. But when something revolutionary happens, those rules don't apply anymore. And whether what's coming is simply an oddity or an anomaly that will blow over, or is a genuine revolutionary change, we don't have rules for that yet. Once it establishes itself, a community of interpreters will form around it, and they'll create a body of rules, and they'll write books, and the apprentices in that discipline will learn the rules until some apprentice comes along and throws that into question. And that's the way we make progress. We don't make progress in a sort of steady, continuous way. We have these discontinuous shifts that require imagination and insight. That's why Einstein was great about this stuff. Einstein said imagination is more important than information in science. And that's right, because when he was a young man and he started putting these, first of all, he couldn't get a job because he was working in a patent office. He was a young PhD, couldn't get a job working in a patent office because people were a little bit, his professors were a little bit suspicious of him. And then when he published those revolutionary papers in 1905, first reaction was, it's crazy. Why? Well, there weren't any criteria there to judge whether this was good science or not, because he was changing what science, the meaning of science. Picasso was changing the meaning of art. Luther was changing the meaning of theology. It happens across the board. It's not confined to simply science. It's all of our modes of investigation are, I think, governed by this law of work inside the framework, work that questions the framework and changes it. And that's where I think the most interesting sense of truth is. So you have sort of propositional truths that you can prove because you've got rules. And then you got somebody who comes along who says something that's going to turn out to be true, but we just don't realize that, and we can't tell, and we don't have any rules to determine it.
Or we don't want to accept it either because it's, like you said, truth is something the truth is too painful for us for some reason.
Sometimes it's the truth punishes us. He was thinking, Augustine was thinking about sin. He was thinking sometimes we're just and sometimes we're unjust. And when we're unjust, we don't want to hear about it. And when, if somebody exposes our injustice, you know, we'd rather not hear about it. So he was thinking about sin, but it's not just sin. It's everywhere. It's in every time we, any claim we make, anything we're invested in, we have a tendency, we resist altering it. And if it's because we're afraid it's not in our best interest. We're worried about what's going to become of us if this, or what we've invested ourselves in, what's going to happen to us if this, overtakes us. So what truth requires a certain kind of courage, right? You really, it's not simply, you know, it's not something a computer can do. It requires the courage to put your own presuppositions into question. That's why it's not far removed from faith and hope and, you know, spiritual values. Scientists are passionately devoted. Scientists who make breakthroughs are passionately devoted to their ideas, and in the beginning, they have to just cling with a certain kind of scientific faith in what they're saying, because the evidence is not there yet. What they're proposing is an as yet unproven hypothesis, and that requires a kind of faith, not religious faith in the narrow sense, but a deeper sense of human faith in the future.
Well, you say that wisdom is larger than logic. So is that kind of what you're getting at there?
Sure. It's a lot more. Logic works when you've got premises and you know how to. You can make a computer can do logic. They were invented to do logic. That's where they came from. Computers were first developed by logicians who realized that the logical workings of the mind can be symbolized. You can make rules for the combination of ideas, and you can make you can mechanize thinking. You can, in a certain sense, eliminate thinking and just let the computer calculate. So what you need to do is make a man named Martin Heidegger said, is you need to distinguish thinking from calculation. We can calculate, and we can get computers to calculate for us, and the computers are better than us. But the really challenging thing is the incalculable. And because the incalculable is the thing you run into on the edge. When you start to move towards the edge of the framework and something unusual, anomalous, hard to assimilate happens, you're starting to call the rules of calculation into question, and you need something that is, you're moving into the sphere of the incalculable. So that happens inside science, it happens inside the disciplines, and it also calls upon, it shows you the affinity of what we're trying, when we're seeking truth, the affinity of strictly intellectual work with non-intellectual work. So there are all kinds of things that we can learn that we can't learn by logic, and we learn them from works of art, we learn them from novelists. You know, philosophers and psychologists, when they're looking for their material, one of the places they go to, if they're smart, is literature, because the depths of human experience that are portrayed in works of literature, you know, that doesn't show up in simple rational logical investigation. Literature is plugged into a side of our, or art more generally, is plugged into a dimension of the truth, which is not narrowly logical. It's genuinely true, but it's not merely logical. You can't analyze a poem by its logic. You can't sort of distill the argument that the poet is making. I mean, you can look at the poem and say, yeah, well, he's trying to say, cheer up, you know, or he's trying to say, it's a beautiful day. You could transcribe a poem into an argument, a logical sequence, but you'd kill it. You would miss virtually everything that's truly important about the poem. So,
one thing that I've noticed is some of the best scientists and engineers that I know are very creative. They're musical. They're into some kind of art form. The ones that are really at the edge.
Yeah, that's exactly right. That's exactly right, because they understand that scientific work is more than simply calculation. And what a philosopher would say is, truth is more than simply intellectual truth. And you can see that in just in the varieties of the ways that you use the word true. So you say, is someone being true to what they believe? You know, that means, are they authentic? So truth comes in a lot of forms, and wisdom. But what philosophy is not, the Greek word philosophia doesn't mean literally love of truth. It means literally love of Sophia or wisdom, where wisdom is more than something intellectual. It's also something affective and aesthetic. It has to do with the true, the good, and the beautiful. So there is a human being is a totality of powers, you know, has pulled intellectual power, ethical power, aesthetic powers or faculties. And it's that mesh of beauty and truth and goodness that constitutes wisdom. Wisdom in the largest sense is sort of the, I said in the book, the whole ball of wax. You know, it's this totality. And in the beginning, when philosophers were first starting to get their act together and get going, like Plato and Aristotle, you didn't even have these rigorous distinctions that we have in place among the various disciplines. If you read a book by Plato, so you read his most famous book, The Republic, it'd be very hard put to say, well, is that a work of ethics or of politics or epistemology or science or what is it? Well, it was all those things, because he had a sense of holism. He had a holistic sense of what the truth was, and that was, or the good life was, and that was summarized under the name wisdom. Now, the thing of it is, of course, that was a little bit easier to do than it is now, because now you have a proliferation of scientific of disciplines and of research, so that you have specialists work burrowing in into deep dark corners in science or history or mathematics, and discovering things that no one person could ever really put together in by themselves. Up to around maybe, I don't know, the 19th century, you might have gotten somebody who could do that. But with the explosion of knowledge since then, it's not possible. So the task of what we call philosophy, I mean, the word philosophy just simply meant used to mean seeking wisdom, and that included learning what there was to know. Well, nobody could learn what there is to know now, and it's overwhelming. Even inside your own discipline, you can't possibly know everything there is to know inside your own discipline. But wisdom is the idea that we have to somehow or another hold all that together, and we've got to keep the search for knowledge in step with the good life, with virtue. And we've got to keep the search for knowledge and the search for virtue in step with an aesthetic sensibility. We have to appreciate that science reveals something of splendor, aesthetic splendor. The great scientists understand they're dealing with a very deep and beautiful mystery. And those things can't be separated from their personal ethical, their lives of virtue as scientists. And but that's what, so that's what wisdom means. Wisdom means hope, keeping it all together in a kind of balance in which you don't hold fiercely to disciplinary boundaries, and you have a sense of the whole. And that's very, very, very difficult right now, and that's what I, you know, what philosophers and historians call the postmodern world. The postmodern world is the world of this utter proliferation of alternate ways to be, of with contemporary transportation systems. We're familiar with the multiplicity of cultures. We have a sense of multiplicity and the polymorphic that people didn't have before. When philosophers were talking about what the world was like before, say, right up to the very beginning of the 19th century, they had a much more manageable world in mind. When Aristotle was talking about philosophy, he had in mind a polis, you know, a Greek city-state that was, you know, maybe 5 or 10,000 people, and only, of which only maybe 5% of the people could read and write. So he had a, and when European philosophers are talking about philosophy up through the 19th century, they have in mind monogamous nation-states, maybe they were monogamous too, but they have a homologous, you know, uniform nation states. Now we have ethnic multiplicity, we have world travel, we have instant communication across the world. You and I are sitting here talking to one another in virtual space. The world has become polymorphic, polychromatic, and it's very, very confusing. And so the question that traditional philosophers have is, can you have any sense of wisdom, where that means keeping the whole in view? Can you possibly do that in a world that in which information, transportation, communication has multiplied beyond control?
Can you talk, since we have about 15 minutes left, I want to get into some of the profound thing, not that this isn't profound, because I think it is, and I think it's kind of the truth of our, or the issue of our time. But you also talk about what the kingdom of God really is. And you talk about pure love and unconditional, but you relate it to the world and what we do. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, my specialty as a my we just got done talking about being holistic, and I say my specialty is the angle from which I approach all this is the philosophy of religion, and I make a distinction between sort of what you might call garden variety religion, religion in the ordinary sense, the church going religion with sacred scriptures and rites and communities that have a body of beliefs that they all sign on to. And I'm not by any means trying to condemn that, but I want to sort of open it up, you know, to something else, because I think that there is what's going on in those particular religious traditions is something deeper, which can't be confined to the that religious tradition. I think it's what those particular religious traditions are doing is sort of, you might say, they're operating with certain symbols that are symbols of something that is beyond that. They're operating within certain concrete conditions, but they're talking about something which is unconditional. So when they say faith, they mean believing, you know, in the resurrection, you know, or the incarnation, or in the law of Moses, or whatever the faith body is teaching. But I say, well, let's call that belief, and distinguish that from something, from a deeper faith, which is our faith in the future, our faith in the possibility of community and justice and peace. So I say, when you look at what's going on, when Christians read the New Testament, it's all about the New Testament. It's all about what Jesus calls the kingdom of God. And I say, well, you know, the kingdom of God is a kind of symbolic way of speaking. It's I think of Jesus as a poet who is writing a poem about the what he's calling the kingdom of God, which has to do with a deep compassion and sense of mercy and an extraordinary idea of loving your enemies. That's mad.
It's a blasphemy almost, right?
Yeah, it's and nobody can do that. You know, and it's impossible what he's asking for, to love your enemies. So he's holding up before us a vision that is utterly confounding. You know, it's just, how could you do that? And it's interesting if you read the philosophers. That's why I'm interested in religion, because religious people are likely to say something like that on you. Whereas if you read the philosophers, they're trying to give you sort of logical argument about things, and that's important too. I don't want to dismiss that. But when you turn to religion, you find these breakthrough visions of things. Now, what I don't think you should do with that is literalize them and think that he really, that there really is literally, because I must say I don't think there is. There really is literally a time when God is going to come breaking into the world, dispel the powers of this world, and establish the rule of God. That's what Jesus was talking about. Now I don't think that's going to happen. And I don't think that's the way we today can make sense of these texts. But I do think that a vision is being proposed there of something gripping, powerful, inspiring, scary, putting us on the spot, making us responsible for one another, holding out an ideal of something that, as a philosopher, I like to call the unconditional. So what's that mean? Well, look, suppose you got a doctor who's got an extremely successful practice in a very comfortable suburban neighborhood, who simply drops it and goes off to West Africa to fight the spread of the Ebola virus, puts himself or herself in harm's way, putting their own lives at risk to help a bunch of people that they don't even know. You say, well, what's that all about? What's going on there? Well, there I think you have someone who has an investment in something unconditional, something of unconditional value, in which they're willing to put themselves in harm's way in order to make it, to bring it about. And that, I think, is the deep structure of religion. I think that's what's actually going on in religion. And religious traditions, they all have stories like this, you know, loving your neighbor, and these extraordinary, or loving your enemy, these extraordinary sort of breakthrough visions of things that I don't think you want to literalize, but I do think that if you treat them as symbols, they are very important symbols of this thing called the unconditional, a willingness to invest yourself and to expose yourself and let yourself be overtaken by something of unconditional value. It can happen in medicine. It's those nurses working with pediatric oncologists. It happens in political life when people put their careers on the line in the name of what they think is right or wrong. It happens in science. It happens in art. It happens again and again and again. One of my favorite examples is from sort of from popular culture, and that is, one time my wife and I were and I think I may have told the story in the book. We were in Belfast, and we walked by and we saw a poster for the Titanic Museum, and so we said, "Oh, we got to go see that." And we were walking over to the museum, and we said, "Remember that scene in the movie where the string quartet was playing, and the ship's going down, and everybody's running for a lifeboat, but the string quartet continues to play?" And I said, "That's probably Hollywood, right? I mean, that didn't really happen." So we get to the museum, and there it is. There's pictures of the string quartet, and there are accounts of that episode. That really did happen. You say, "Well, what were they doing? What were they thinking about? You know, were they weren't trying to get in good with their employer, you know, and get a raise for their next job, you know, because there wasn't going to be a next job. They weren't thinking of becoming famous because they figured they were going to go down into the dark blue depths of the ocean that night and nobody was going to know about that, what they were doing. What were they doing?" I think, well, they were saying, this is what life will have been about. This is what our life is and what it has meant. And they were sort of bidding a kind of fond adieu. If they just wanted to be brave, they could have put the violins down and hurried to help people get onto the lifeboats. If they just wanted to exercise moral courage, you know, they would have helped people, helped the women and children off the boat. But what they did was not, I don't think, a moral courage. It was a kind of deeper, more radical courage about being or life itself. And that I think is, they were affirming the unconditional beauty of life with all of its mortality and tragic, you know, all the tragedy that besets us. Now, suppose all four of them, hopefully, I would like it to be the case that all four of them were atheists by the standard definition of religious faith. Then that would make my example perfect, because then I could say, here's a case where you have the deep structure of what's going on in religion without the religious beliefs. Or if one of these Doctors Without Borders people is a completely secular person by the standard definition of religion. There's a certain deep structure of religion, which is the religion of what's of unconditional importance, which is not at odds with ordinary religion, although sometimes it is, because sometimes ordinary religion is more trouble than it's worth. But it's what's going on in religion. That's why I don't think there's any such thing as the one true religion. I think all of them are different symbolic ways of signifying in a conditional way something of unconditional importance, something inbreaking, something shattering, something that changes us and transforms us and calls us out beyond ourselves and represents the genuine depth of human life. So if you're not religious in my sense, it's because the only thing that really interests you is your stock portfolio or your self-interest. So that's what I mean by the unconditional, and that's what. I think that for Christians who read the New Testament, the kingdom of God is a symbol of something unconditional.
So if somebody's unconditional, it shows that unconditional act of love, if you will, or whatever that deep thing is that you're talking about, and they're an atheist. Would you say that they're an atheist in the sense of what we see religions to be, but not in the sense of what you think the deep understanding of the kingdom of God is?
Yes, I would say they're. What I would say is that they are. The expression that one of my favorite philosophers uses is religion without religion. You know, a kind of proto-religion that's running beneath confessional religion. You can distinguish confessional religions from a more radical religion. And I think this more radical religion goes to the very makeup of the human heart, and you can find it either with or without the confessional religion. And more and more and more today, particularly in Western Europe, not quite so much in the United States, more and more today, culture is secularizing. But it's secularizing about confessional religion. I don't think that it ought to give up on this deeper sense of religion. Otherwise, we're going to just simply dissipate into a lot of self-seeking, neoliberal, capitalist, greedy individuals. And our sense of the depth of life is going to dissipate.
Well, one thing that you brought up, and I read this, now that you've brought up capitalism, is one thing you said is capitalism is a perfect example of instrumental reason. So there is a form of capitalism that is good.
Yeah, I mean, it's means and thinking, right? You try to devise an effective economic system, and it's the least bad economic system we've come up with. It's like democracy. It's based upon a seriously questionable premise, and that is self-seeking. So it hopes that all these self-seekers will adjudicate one another's, adjust to one another's needs, and some invisible hand, which is a sort of secular metaphor for divine providence, some invisible hand is going to see that it all works out smoothly. Well, That's an ideal, that's not going to happen. The premise that's underneath it, I don't like the premise underneath capitalism, which is self-seeking. But if it's moderated, if it's regulated, and if it's constantly interrupted, then it'll work. So if everything is an economy, then the lawyers are going to run everything. Then everybody, then people will only do things if it's the rules. I got involved in politics once in my life, and that was when my kids were little, and there was a fight about the school budget in our school district, and there were people who wanted to cut the budget, and there were people who wanted to expand the budget because they said that the children are the future, right? So I got into this argument. And the only really good argument we had to the people who wanted to cut our school budget was, if you said the children are the future, the schools are the melting pot of democracy, this is how you make a nation, made no dent on. But if you said it's going to affect your property values. And then, oh, well, that's an interesting argument. They could hear that argument. The teachers were saying to them, okay, do you want us to, if you want us to simply live by this contract, then that's what we're going to do. We're going to do what they call work the contract. That is, we're going to do what we're being paid to do, and we're not doing one dime's worth of extra. We're not going to answer a phone call after the school day's over. We're not going to talk to a student after the school day's over. We're not going to take any interest that is not demanded by the contract. And what will happen to the schools if you do that? What will happen to the schools if all you've got is the contract? The schools will corrupt. They'll collapse. There'll be nothing left. It'll just be a machine. How does the contract work? If you're willing to interrupt the contract and do what the contract doesn't demand, if you do something more, so if you let the economic system, the means, ends, calculative rationality rule everything, you'll ruin it. The only thing that makes it work is if you keep interrupting it by unselfishness. Not just unselfish employees who are willing to work to make sure this job is done well, because that really matters to them, but also employers who are willing to go the extra mile for their employees, because they're not just employees. because there's something more important going on here, and it's not being spelled out by employer-employee contracts. It's not simply means-ends rationality. It's not simply economics. It's something, pardon the expression, unconditional. It's something where work really means something, and it's not just a means-ends calculation.